even despite the fact that genealogy is actually one of the most popular hobbies in the world, a lot of people feel very fearful and suspicious of it. And really, it's the educated viewpoint. You know, it's the sort of the sophisticated consensus that looking back is silly, that it can't explain anything. And I think this really just goes directly back to World War II, to Nazi Germany, to the terrible eugenics that happened there, the ways in which minorities and which Jewish people in particular were at first very much discriminated against and then finally exterminated for who they were, for who their families were. This actually happened to some lesser extent in America. And in fact, Germany was greatly influenced by eugenics in America, which is something most people don't know.
Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by journalist and linguist Christine Keneally, author of the new book, The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Now, this explores the history of genealogy and ancestry through the lens of genetics. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a show about how visionaries integrate life, work, and passion.
There are still people today who were sterilized in state organized sterilization campaigns that were eugenically motivated. Someone in the political spectrum decided that certain people weren't fit to bear children and they sterilized them. So even today, there's litigation going on.
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer, the civil rights activist, was one of those people who was sterilized, and it drove her deeper into her activism, in fact.
Right. And, you know, and thank God for people like that. Thank God for people who sort of found the strength. But there were so many people who were very poor, who were uneducated and who were treated in this way and didn't have any redress at all. But in fact, you know, that's not what is happening these days. And the science has changed so much. We've come so far since Mendel. We can read someone's entire genome. And most people, for less than $100, can get access to a huge amount of information about their genome. So there's a lot of potential there for these incredible ways we can learn about ourselves. We can learn about our histories. We can learn about the ways in which the history of the world is actually far more textured than any of the eugenicists would have you believe. But we can also learn this very important health information as well. So I think it's time for us to put aside our fears. I mean, it's time for us to be clear about, you know, why eugenics is a terrible idea, but also to embrace the new knowledge about our genealogies and about our DNA and these other things that get passed down to us.
So your book covers so much territory, there's no way we're going to get to it all. But I was reading the part about Gregor Mendel, who was a researcher born in the 1820s in Moravia, now part of the Czech Republic, and looking at how traits are passed down. And what leapt to mind immediately was House Baratheon and House Lannister and who has dark hair, and would a dark-haired guy and a blonde-haired woman be able to produce a whole bunch of blonde-haired children? That's, if you don't watch Game of Thrones, that will only make sense just in terms of dark and light hair. But, you know, tell me a little bit about what you are attempting to do in this book, because it's masterful, but it just covers a lot of ground.
Sure. And indeed, I'm a big fan of Game of Thrones. So I love your analogy. And I guess that's one of those examples of what you get to do in fiction you don't necessarily get to do in reality. But you're right. It all started with Mendel, who worked out by breeding peas, of all things, the ways in which traits can be passed down from one generation to another, the way that a trait might be dominant or recessive. It might appear in one generation, or it might take two or three generations to appear again. So that's kind of where it all began. And that's where we began to think in a modern way about genetics and the things that get passed down. So intellectually, these questions have always been really interesting to me. But emotionally, I guess, you know, where all this stuff began was this incident that happened for me when I was 8 years old. I got an assignment from my teacher, which is, I think, a very common assignment a lot of people would be familiar with this. She explained to us what a family tree was. And the idea was to go home, to share it with our parents, to get them to help us fill it out. I was really excited about this, but my parents were actually quite startled by it, and they felt it was an invasion of their privacy. So this emotionally kicked off all these questions for me about, you know, what gets passed down, what the people who've come before us, people perhaps who we never knew of before, you know, what things we might carry from them. In fact, I discovered years later that my father's father, at least the person we thought was his father, was actually his grandfather, and that his father was someone who he had no idea about. He didn't know his name. He didn't know what had happened to him. So these kind of questions about, you know, I carry approximately 25% of this man's DNA. You know, what is it possible to get from someone, even if you've never met them or heard of them before?
A friend of mine wrote a book called Bird of Paradise, and it really dealt with her ancestry. Her name is Raquel Cepeda, and she dealt with her ancestry as a Dominican American who has bloodlines tested by DNA that range through the Berbers of Morocco. Wow. Mongolians, I don't even know how they got in her bloodline, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it fascinates me in some ways that we're in a world where people in Europe, for example, don't want Google Street View, but yet at the same time, there's like this rush to go out and get genetically tested, which might tell a lot more than the facade of your house. I mean, how do you parse out the kind of human desire to know with the human desire for privacy?
Yeah, you know, that's a really hard one. And I think that's one we're all working out right now. I think our generation is a pioneering generation. We've just started to access this information through our DNA. And because of the internet, all this documentation is now available to us as well. It's not just our genetic history, it's our history. It's what we can read in documents that before you might have had to have sort of found a church cellar in another country and, you know, gone down there and looked up someone who'd come before you. But now a lot of that's already on the internet. You can look it up in 5 minutes. You know more than you could have ever possibly imagined. Then again, of course, you're right. At the same time, there are these concerns about privacy and the misuse of our data. And I think we'll have this sorted out in one or two generations. I think a lot of the fear will be gone by then. But I do think we all need to be thinking about the ways in which I think the government can support us. The government needs to facilitate our relationship with our own genome instead of getting between it. And, you know, and protect us from companies that, you know, perhaps might use it in a less than benevolent way.
You talk about genomes, but you also talk about family history. And I was really fascinated by your writing about Marshall Duke, who developed a set of questions that basically tried to see how deeply people knew their family history and found that people who scored higher on this family history test also scored higher on measures of self-esteem and self-control and had less anxiety. Some people, like your own family, with what you're saying, have different reasons that they don't want to disclose parts of the family history. Other people are obsessive about it, and my family's pretty on the obsessive side. And it's been a great pleasure to get to know some of the people who are long gone and what they did. But talk about that a little bit. I mean, it's not about genetics or genomics, but it's about who are your people and what that does for you if you know.
Absolutely. That was such a fascinating study by the psychologist, by Marshall Duke. And I think it speaks to the culture that we have around information. And, you know, that I think is going to become increasingly important as we go on, as we talk more about just simply information, the status of information and data in our lives. So Duke found that children who knew more about their family history seemed to have this great emotional resilience compared to children who didn't. And that he even looked at kids who'd gone through September 11 and had lost someone. And those who knew more about their family history did better in the wake of that terrible event. So he called this the intergenerational self. And you're right. So it's not genetic. It is a cultural thing. And it's not even necessarily about the information itself. I think Duke's idea was that it testifies to the conversations that take place in a family. And because, of course, it's really natural to talk about who we are, where we're from, the stories that shaped us, the people that we remember. These were the conversations taking place in these children's families, and just simply as a matter of course, they acquired all this information about their own family history. So I think, you know, there's a question for people like me, for those of us who perhaps there were blockages around information. I mean, certainly in my case, the great emotion with which my parents responded to that fairly innocent question when I was 8 years old stayed with me for a very long time. And, you know, my parents and I talk about it now. You know, if you don't want your children to grow up and write a book about the thing that you want to keep secret, you're going to have to perhaps be a little smoother about it. Or, you know, hopefully these days people are more comfortable talking about things like that. All that judgment around illegitimacy that was such a terrible thing in the 1930s when my father was born is just not the same anymore.
So Jack Nicholson found out that the woman he thought was his mother was actually his sister. And the woman who raised him as his mother was his grandmother, because his sister was a young mother. And so they raised them as siblings. And I think that story, which he came out with quite late in life, is an example of what you're talking about. But also, I was speaking with Gloria Steinem on a previous podcast, and she said that a study during the 1950s found that, you know, about 20% of kids couldn't possibly have been the genetic offspring of their so-called fathers. So it's a really interesting, I mean, sometimes I wonder if this is a Pandora's box, and sometimes people don't want to know, because now we're in the era of Maury Povich paternity test, and it's all like nasty and gross. But do you think we'll evolve interpersonally to be able to accept some of these things better?
I do. And I think the transition to that place is a slightly challenging one, because I think the only way to get to that place is to look at the information that we can look at, to look at the DNA, to look at the documents, and, you know, in a lot of cases, to let those secrets go and to share that information. And, you know, obviously all families have secrets to the extent that there is information that's just not appropriate to share with a young child, for example. But, you know, it's the tension around that stuff that I think becomes problematic. But what's interesting too is, you know, you mentioned that Gloria Steinem statistic. And so that's a statistic that's often used to suggest that, in fact, this activity of looking back, of asking about the past, is really a pointless activity, because you don't know who that person is, and because there are so many cases of illegitimacy. And it, despite the fact that that was my family's story, it's actually not the case. Now that we're getting a lot more data, now that we're getting the DNA, and now that we're sort of getting people connecting with each other, you know, these vast networks of second cousins and third cousins, the illegitimacy rate is much, much lower than that. So when you're looking back into the past, there's a really good chance, there's an extremely overwhelming probability along the male line that, you know, your genealogical relative is also your genetic relative. So that's what we're going to find out. We're going to find out that these myths, whether they're the scary ones or whether they're the ones that are attempting to sort of puncture those fears, are actually myths, and we'll actually start dealing with the data and then building our stories from that.
Let's talk about a couple of the mechanisms that have gone into the genealogical side, and then I want to go back to the genetic side. So you studied both the Church of Latter-day Saints and their Granite Mountain Record Vault and the Doomsday Book, and you also looked at Chinese concepts of ancestry, both following the lineage of Confucius, but also the things that happened during the Cultural Revolution. I'm not going to ask you to sum all of those up, but maybe give a couple of insights about how culture affects how we view genealogy.
Sure. So let me start with Baiying Bojigang. He is a Chinese man that I interviewed, and he just went through this very heartbreaking experience during the Cultural Revolution in China. He was a young child at the time. And in fact, Asian culture has been doing genealogy for much, much longer than Western cultures. And it's not uncommon in many families to have documentation that goes back not just hundreds, but potentially thousands of years. So their history is incredibly rich. And they've never gone through this phase, the sort of pop culture phase of questioning whether genealogy is interesting or important. It just is. But in fact, what happened during the Cultural Revolution was that any sign of sort of being bourgeoisie or middle class was seen to be very bad. And people who looked after their family histories fell into that category. People who respected their ancestors by sweeping out the family tomb. It just wasn't good to be caught doing that anymore. So Baiying grew up when these bands of young men called the Red Guard were roaming the streets. And one night the Red Guard were on his street and his father grabbed him. They went down to their basement and they grabbed this documentation, which had been passed down to them for 10 generations. And it included information about 40 different ancestors. And it had hand-drawn portraits, which had been drawn hundreds of years ago, of these people. And they had to burn them, or else they would have been pulled out of their houses and potentially killed. So they burned them, they destroyed that. And this was something that haunted Baiying's father for the rest of his life, the loss of that basic information. And Baiying made it, you know, his life's work, really, to try to recover that, because there is so much documentation in China about these larger networks of family. He was able to recover quite a lot of that. So that's to me, such a powerful indication of just the value of just this information to future generations. But actually passing information on is a really challenging thing to do. One of my favorite stories is about the Domesday Book, which is a two volumes that were created actually in 1086 in England by William the Conqueror. And they're essentially, I guess, tax forms. He sent all these people out across the country. They took information about the names of people who were living in different regions and what their holdings of land were so that ultimately they could be taxed. But this has become this incredible document about life 1,000 years ago, about who was there, and information about surnames that are still there in the country today. So, you know, in the 1980s, the BBC and a computer company decided that they wanted to try to do a second edition of the Domesday Book. And they got people to volunteer from all over the country. 1 million people contributed information to this new Domesday Book. And it, you know, was completely new technology. It was a laser disc. There was sort of other media that they essentially had to invent in order to bring all this information together. So the idea was that this new Domesday Book would last many, many thousands of years longer than the one from 1086, which had been written on, you know, sheepskin. And in fact, it was less than 20 years and they couldn't actually access any of the information in it at all because our media rolls over so fast these days. We go, you know, in music, we started with 8-track and now we're on CDs, and actually now CDs are kind of passe and everyone downloads things digitally. So it was this really terrible lesson in how information will get lost, not just because of these huge cultural upheavals, but because you've got to be really careful where and how you write it down. And that's something, of course, we're all still working on. And the Mormons are really interesting because they were leaders in microfilm technology in the 1940s because they really care about genealogy. They were writing this stuff down then. They're now transferring it to, they're digitizing a lot of their information. And they've gone so far as to build this massive vault inside a granite mountain in Utah to keep all that information safe in case something terrible happens on the outside.
Well, I want to wrap up with a little bit of your findings about genealogy from the genome point. You talk about groups of people ranging from the Picts to the Bantus of Africa, but I really thought that your chapter on the politics of genealogy and groups like the Melungeons, who are a mixed race American group who thought they were one thing and then learned they were another thing, and Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Let's just end on a note of what you learned not just about genealogy and genetics, but also how we politicize these things.
Right. So that's the danger. That's the danger of looking into the genome and finding these differences between people's ancestry. And then there's the concern that that's going to be used against people, just like genealogy was once used against people. So there are enormous politics around this right now. And there are people who caution against even looking at your own genome, lest you find something disturbing. There are people who caution against analyzing the genomes of different groups of people, lest one group be held up above the other. But again, the truth will set you free. And the truth is, you know, there is no race in the genome. There are no qualitative differences between people in their genome. DNA does not tell us that some people are better than others. What DNA tells us is that everyone has a textured history, that some people are adapted to certain areas historically better than others, but that within this incredible sameness of the human race, we have these really interesting differences. And these differences are stories. They're stories about our immediate family, and they're stories about, you know, the vast reaches of history. And, you know, all of humanity is written in the genome of everyone. So that's a really important part of what we now know and why the politics, you know, we need to leave that politics aside. And then sort of perhaps the most important thing, and the sort of apart from the general truth, the specific truths you can see in the story of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings and the evidence we now have that indeed Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson had children together. This was denied for so very long. And it just wasn't the case. These stories had been passed down in slave groups, in fact, and the DNA has proven them to be right.
So before I let you go, I want you to play a little game we call Exquisite, where a previous guest on One with Farai asks a question of the current one. So take a listen.
Is there a country that you have not been but you would like to travel to, and why, and what would you like to do there?
So, Christine, what would you say?
So I have not been to Siberia. I would love to go to Siberia. There's an incredible experiment that's been happening there for generations. It's actually generations of foxes, not generations of humans. They've been domesticating wild foxes and showing that when you select generation after generation of friendly foxes, you end up with incredibly friendly, tame foxes, but that you also get all these biological differences that accompany domestication. You get floppy, adorable ears, you get soft fur, you get floppy tails. And it's just, I think, one of the most interesting experiments that's happened in the world, really. I would love to meet those foxes. And the same people who've been creating these friendly foxes have also been breeding rats for aggression, for the opposite of friendliness. So between sort of as long as there's a thick glass wall between us, I'd love to see those rats as well.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. And I have read about that fox study.
Yeah.
So, Christine, now it's your turn to toss a question to the next person. You won't know who it is and you can ask them anything.
So the question I want to ask is, do you know one of your great grandmother's names? If you don't, why don't you? And if you do, tell us a bit about her.
That's fantastic. So you're going to find out the answer to Christine's question on the next episode of One with Farai. So thank you for joining us.
Farai, thanks so much. It's been really lovely.
Journalist Christine Keneally is the author of The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. And we'd like to thank a few of our supporters, including Paula Puhak, Simon Fought, Lalita Tatami, and the Aaron and Sylvia Rothenberg Family Foundation. Visit soundworks.org to find other podcasts as well as past episodes of One with Farai.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.